He is Amit Kaur. I am Telly Concepcion. And together, we are Beyond the Numbers Podcast. We go beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. So come learn, grow, and have some fun with us. We are Beyond the Numbers Podcast.
On today's episode, the guys discuss The Last Dance, episodes 5 and 6, Michael Jordan versus the Dream Team versus Isaiah Thomas. They also look at Michael and Kobe's relationship and go beyond the numbers of MJ's time with the Wizards. But first, their numbers of the day.
My number for the day is 7. That is on May 8th, 2016, Bryce Harper reached base 7 times without recording an actual at-bat, an official at-bat.
My number for the day is 60, as in Amit, it's been 60 days without basketball. Basketball season was suspended March 11th of 2020 due to COVID-19.
I feel like we haven't played in over a year at this point.
Yeah, it does feel like that. It definitely feels like that. We'd like to dedicate this episode to Ahmaud Arbery. We'd also like to wish a very happy Mother's Day to our moms. Without you, we wouldn't be in a position to do what we love, so thank you. Love you, Mom. And to all the mothers out there, happy Mother's Day. For our first story, we go beyond the numbers of Michael Jordan with the Washington Wizards. Our numbers for this story, 22.9 and 40. Jordan averaged 22.9 points in his return seasons, and 40 was Jordan's age midway through his final season.
For those of you that don't know, following The Last Dance, Michael Jordan retired and stayed retired. But after 3 years, he ultimately returned to the game. Why the Wizards? Why the comeback? Was he any good? Did he soil his reputation? Let's go beyond the numbers and look at what Jordan did with the Wizards. Mike had the perfect ending. So why did he come back?
I actually don't think it's as simple as he had an itch to scratch. I think there was a lot of things that played into it, but he was actually trying to become an owner and the first Black owner of an NBA franchise and the first player to be a majority owner at that. NBA Commissioner David Stern at the time prompted his interest in owning a team, and Jordan was actually linked to buying the Milwaukee Bucks, the Denver Nuggets, and the Vancouver Grizzlies at different times during his retirement. But on his bid to purchase the Charlotte Hornets, and that would have been his hometown team, he's from Charlotte, North Carolina, fell through. That's when his front office bid with the Wizards began. As part of that deal, Jordan was given 5 years as team president, and the deal would also have allowed him his ownership stake in the team to grow to as much as 20%, which would have given him the largest stake among any Black owners, including Magic Johnson, that owns part of the Lakers, a small part of the Lakers, and Shaq, who owns a small part of the Sacramento Kings.
Funny to look at it now, you know, once at the back end of things, Jordan actually did become an investor with the then Bobcats, now Hornets, in 2006. And then he ended up taking over the controlling ownership of the Bobcats in 2010 when he bought out his other partners there. And when he bought control of that franchise, just to give you an idea of just like the amount of money involved, it was valued, the franchise was valued at $280 million. He sold his stake in the Hornets in 2019, and at that point it was valued at $1.5 billion. So the investors who purchased it probably didn't pay the $1.5 billion valuation for their stake, but you're looking at over a 750% increase in value from when Jordan bought the franchise, or at least bought control of the franchise, to when it was sold last year. Pretty crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. And to get to that point, again, I think he had a service time as team president for the Wizards, which gave him the opportunity to become a partial owner and eventually gave him 20% of the Wizards to sell and have the money to put in a bid for the Hornets like he has now. So following his final season with Chicago, Michael was on vacation in the Bahamas and he sliced his right index finger so bad with a cigar cutter that he required surgery. He severed the tendon, and actually he disclosed later on that he could no longer palm a basketball or pick it up off the dribble, which is crazy to think because the majority of Jordan highlights you see, he's palming the basketball behind his back. He's driving to the lane. He's dunking with one hand. While he's figuring out if he wants to return, he did a pickup practice game and Ron Artest breaks two of his ribs, Michael. Ron Artest, not Meta World Peace. I don't think Meta World Peace is breaking ribs now, but Ron Artest definitely did. And after all that, Mike still decided he wanted to return. I think ultimately he felt like he can contribute more to the team on the floor, teach the guys, kind of coach from the floor, from that position on the floor instead of being team president. And Mike hires an old friend, Amit, to be the head basketball coach of the Washington Wizards. An old friend that we've learned about on The Last Dance, Doug Collins.
Yeah. I think Doug Collins kind of got his redemption tour.
Yeah, you could call it that. So Mike calls him up and says, I need help, Doug. And Doug says, you know, when Mike calls for help, you go. So how did Wizards year one go for Michael Jordan? How did this experiment, his return from retirement, go? So on December 27, 2001, Michael Jordan scored a career-low 6 points against the Indiana Pacers, which snapped his record 866-game streak of scoring double figures. So it kind of looks like that's what we're going to get out of Mike, right, in this return. 2 nights later, he responds by scoring 51, Mike. 51, Amit. Going 21 for 38 from the field, 9 for 10 on the free throw line, and he became the oldest player in history to score 50 or more in a game. He also set the record for points in a quarter against the Charlotte Hornets, scoring 24 points in the first quarter.
You've got to believe that he had some sort of motivation in his head after he was being tied to purchasing the Hornets.
Oh, yeah. You know that was part of his mindset. You know that's how Jordan thought. Yeah. And, you know, he had that killer mentality. He follows that up with 45 points, 10 rebounds, 7 assists, 3 steals against the New Jersey Nets, including scoring 22 points in a row for a stretch of that game.
So the old man still has it.
So the old man had it. And you can say, you know, during his first season with the Wizards, mind you, at age 38 and 39, okay, he averaged 22.9 points, 5.7 rebounds, 5.2 assists on 41% shooting. And just to put that into perspective, D-Wade's 2012-2013 season, he averaged about the same, 21.1 points, 4.9 rebounds, 4.8 assists on 50% shooting.
And if we look at just this past year or this current season that's currently paused, there are only 18 players in the league averaging more than 21 points a game.
Which is 18. Crazy. That's a mind-blowing stat. 39-year-old Jordan is scoring more than scoring within the top 20 of today's league. Just think about that. And the today's league average player is around 22, 23 years old. So put that into perspective. Before Jordan tore his lateral meniscus, which cut his season short, he was in conversation for MVP that season, legitimately. The New York Times proclaimed him to be a viable MVP candidate, and he was actually the talk of the NBA season. He was one of only two players on it in the entire league to average 25 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists during the first half of the year. Any idea who the other guy doing that year was? None other.
I think
22-year-old. A 22-year-old was doing it.
Yeah, was it Kobe?
Kobe Bean Bryant was the only other guy doing it. Mind you, 22-year-old Kobe is the only other guy putting up stats with 39-year-old Michael Jordan. And despite the injuries and wear and tear on his body, Jordan still played 60 games out of the 82 that season, and his numbers were improving throughout the course of the season as he adjusted to his new team and his new role. Remember, he doesn't have Scottie, he doesn't have Dennis Rodman at this point. He's coming back off of three seasons off. And after all of that, he still gets 13th in MVP voting that season with only playing 60 games. Kobe was fifth. Tim Duncan ultimately won it. So how does he follow that up? That's the question. So he didn't sully his name. In year two, he decides to come off the bench, Ahmed, to avoid injuries. And injuries doomed his season before it started because he ends up being the only Wizard to play in all 82 games. And the 40-year-old man at this point averaged 37 minutes a game, which is crazy. He still averaged 20 points a game. He put up 30 points more than 9 times. He put up 40 points more than 3 times. And he became the only player ever to score 40 points at the age of 40. So they call that a 40 for 40. You know, ESPN got 30 for 30s. Jordan dropped a 40 for 40.
He's averaging 30 minutes a game at 40.
Yes.
If we look at this year's league right now, the highest average number of minutes played per game is 36.9.
Tied.
He's highest. No one is playing more than that right now.
No. Well, we're in the age of, you know, we're in the age of rest and
load management.
Yep, load management. So he dropped 43 on the Nets, including the game winner. And Ahmed, let's take it to NYC. You know what I'm saying? I know that's hometown.
Of course.
And you know, Madison Square Garden was Jordan's favorite place to play. And on his last game, his real last game, we saw in the Last Dance, Bloody Shoe. But in his real last game at Madison Square Garden, he scores 39 points, 8 rebounds in a Sunday night game that was so electric that the Knicks crowd was chanting for Michael, who had crushed their dreams. Not just a few years ago, they hated that man.
I mean, that's what MSG is, right? It's where other people come and shine the brightest.
Yeah, you could put it that way. So the old man still play? That was our question coming into this segment. Was Michael's return to the game successful? Did he ruin his reputation by returning? Well, Ahmed, let's go to the 2003 All-Star game played in Atlanta, Georgia. His head coach was Isaiah Thomas, his rival.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit of friction there.
Which is crazy. And Michael wasn't selected a starter, but ultimately Vince Carter offered up his starting spot to him. It was based on voting. MJ missed his first 7 shots, but eventually scored 20 points, including the game winner with 5 seconds left on the clock. With the best competition on earth, he still got it. Walk away from the game, right? Enter Kobe Bryant ruining his walk-off from the All-Star game, sinking some free throws, taking it to another overtime, and the West eventually wins the game. But as we said, Ahmed, I think he still had it based on those numbers.
He could still play. He could definitely still play. The averages are astounding for someone his age. It'll be interesting to see what some of the guys playing in the league right now, because if they're doing all this load balancing and load management and all that, I think the goal is longevity. So it'll be fun to see how some of these stars, as they reach their mid to late 30s, if they can even come close to the numbers Mike dropped.
For our second story today, we dive into episode 5 of The Last Dance. Ahmed, I think it's the best one yet. It starts with the dedication of Kobe Bryant and the 1998 All-Star Game in your hometown, Madison Square Garden, New York City.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy to see Kobe there just as a kid, you know, and it was kind of neat to see him get a chance to get in and have that piece where he got to talk about how impressed he was with Jordan's speed and strength and quickness. And you kind of get a little background on just how that relationship was there. Like, I don't think a lot of people knew how close they were to each other until, of course, after he passed. But it was there was definitely a big brother, little brother mentorship piece there. And it was fun to see that at that All-Star game that early in his career, all the old guard saw him as who he was, right? A guy that wanted to play isolation basketball, take yeah. charge of the game, and just go with it.
Yeah. And it was fun to see the locker room, man. Like, just see all of the guys we idolized, all of these stars hanging in the locker room. Then Magic walks in and Mike's pissed because he's like, dude, you're wearing a purple and yellow tie like you a coach or something. You ain't no coach. Get out of here. And you see, like, the real side of Magic, because, you know, everything that happened with the Lakers this offseason, you hear Magic's really cutthroat and Magic really minces no words. And you got to see a piece of that before he cleaned himself up and kind of buttoned it down when he saw the cameras were around. So Magic even had that mentality back then. Then we see Larry Bird and the three of them hanging out, talking about who would beat who, which was a lot of fun. And you talked about the mentor aspect between Michael and Kobe. And I don't think that happened before this time, because he said that little guy, well, I'm cleaning it up, but he said that little guy in the Laker uniform is going to give us problems all night. So I'm like, wow, this is definitely special to get behind the scenes look at what those conversations are like in the locker room for those guys.
Yeah, it was definitely fun. And to see that, you know, at 98, Michael's still on top of his game.
Yeah.
The best.
Yep. And Kobe never backed down and got advice from Michael. And Michael was sharing his advice. I think Michael saw himself in Kobe, a guy that wouldn't back down, a guy that wasn't scared, a guy that wasn't scared to compete against the best no matter what, but also ask questions like, how can I get better?
Agreed. And you heard Michael talk a lot about it in when he did the memorial service. He talked a lot about those conversations, the late night phone calls, the texts, the sort of the Kobe was relentless, even in asking for help and guidance. I think he saw himself in him. So that was kind of cool to see sort of where it began.
Yeah, he saw a killer. So that was great to just see a lot of that. And like you said, Mike's still at the top of his game, winning MVP of the All-Star game that year in Madison Square Garden, which was his favorite place to play. And they also get into Michael Jordan and Nike shoe deal, okay, which we talked about on Beyond the Numbers, episode 4. So go back, check that out if you get a chance.
Yeah, you know, it's as a Knicks fan, it always hurts when people keep talking about how much they love the Garden, but no one actually wants to come play here. But that's all right. It's okay. Everyone loves the Garden. No one wants to play for the Knicks. What can you do? But it was funny that he ended up wearing those 84 Jordan 1s.
Yeah.
and not like an upgraded version. No, like the originals.
Not the fashion. He went back in the closet and pulled out the ones they signed the deal with and poured his blood into
them.
Yeah. To consummate the deal.
It was so cool because I don't know if a lot of people really know the story behind the sneakers. I know we went into a little bit of detail in episode 4, kind of going through piece by piece, but sort of how they got the idea of Air Jordans because they had the Air Soles and that new Nike technology. And talk about Nike betting right, right? They wanted $3 million in shoe sales in the first 4 years, and they got $126 million in the first year.
Yeah. And the promotion that Nike promised to build the brand around Jordan. And that's really what Jordan was looking for, because as we discussed, Spot Built was the company that matched Nike's offer, but couldn't match the marketing dollars or the marketing potential which Nike had. Nike goes ahead and teams up with Spike Lee to direct and gives us the famous Mars, and it's got to be the shoes.
Yo, Mars Blackman here with my main man, Michael Jordan. Yo, Mike, what makes you the best player in the universe? Is it the vicious dunks?
No, Mars.
Is it the haircut?
No, Mars.
Is it the shoes?
No, Mars.
Is it the extra long shorts?
No, Mars.
Is the shoes it, right?
Nah.
Is it the short socks?
No, Mars.
Money's got to be the shoes. Shoes, 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 shoes.
Fast forward now to this game in the Garden where Spike Lee and Mike are drawing back and forth while wearing the shoes that Spike made the commercial for way back in the day, right?
It was definitely fun to watch him tear it up again at that age. Still in his prime, still doing his thing, wearing shoes that no one else in the league wants to wear because they're old technology, but still able to play his game.
That conversation about the old tech was fascinating because you don't realize we joked about this on episode 4. Playing with Converse, I can't imagine playing basketball with Converse. And, you know, a special side note here, Converse is now owned by Nike. So Nike owns Converse now. But I can't imagine wearing a flat shoe like a Converse and going out and shooting basketballs and running to the hoop and like running back and forth like you have to do with basketball. So it was crazy for him to even acknowledge, like, look, the technology has changed. Like, I can't believe we wore these back in the day. And, you know, now we wear these, you know, now we wear the upgraded version. And just to think, oh, the style has changed. No, the technology has changed.
As the episode progressed, you know, they brought up the Dream Team and they brought up, our one main man that was left off the 92 team, Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah, and they did it in a controversial way, right? Because they straight up asked Michael, like, hey, did you not want him on the team? And Mike said was, look, I had nothing to do with the decision-making process. Now we know Mike was the most powerful player in the world at that point. So if he said he wanted Isaiah on the team, I'm pretty sure they would put Isaiah on the team. So I'm not saying he didn't say he didn't want him on the team, but I'm just saying he didn't want him on the team, you know?
But at that time, you have to remember, and they don't talk about it in the documentary, but the context of this is Michael had already played on an Olympic team when he came up through college. So this wasn't his first Olympic experience.
That's true.
He had done USA basketball before. He was probably fairly exhausted, right? He played a lot of basketball up until this point. You know, the Pistons really beat him up. Like, he was, and we had talked about this last episode about him kind of being tired with basketball and thinking about moving to baseball. So I don't think Michael was sort of a lock-in to be part of the 92 team.
Yeah, the first question he asks is, who's on it? Is as in, I don't want to carry the load. It's how I took that. Like, I don't want to be the guy, the only guy. Like, yeah, you're not going to put this on me, especially with how good some of the teams were around the world. Their games had improved, especially in Croatia. And Isaiah being left off, like you said, something else that's not mentioned. He didn't just have beef with Michael Jordan. I think his beef with Michael Jordan was out there. Like, people knew there was a hatred because of the walk-off, which we discussed last episode, and because of the Jordan rules that were put in place. Not the book that we're talking about this episode, but the actual Jordan rules where the Pistons literally beat him up for three consecutive series. But Isaiah had beefs with Magic Johnson, also on the Dream Team. Isaiah had beefs with Larry Bird because of the Celtics rivalry, also on the Dream Team. And one could argue that Isaiah had more beef with Scottie even with Michael Jordan. And in the documentary, they're talking about how they're hanging out in hotel rooms, they're playing cards. These guys are best of friends. I mean, you got to spend months in a foreign country together. It would just mess with the camaraderie of that team that you have to spend so much time with to bring in someone that has beef with four or five of the best players in the world.
And tell me, who was the coach of the Dream Team in 92?
Chuck Daly.
And who was Isaiah's coach for two titles?
Chuck Daly.
if Isaiah was going to be on that team, Chuck Daly's going to be his biggest advocate. But I have a feeling that he looked at the team, he looked at the dynamics, he looked at the chemistry that they needed and said, nope, this isn't going to work.
Yeah, he knew what it was. And I think Isaiah's that kind of guy that kind of, he rubs against the grain, right? And Jordan, he may have been just as competitive as Jordan, but Michael Jordan, Magic, these guys were charismatic, right? Like, they wanted to kill you, but they would smile and say it, right? And I think Isaiah maybe took a little too far and they just didn't like that.
Yeah.
The other dynamic of the Dream Team is the competition around the world improving, going to Croatia, which had won and were on their way to winning the gold medal pretty much if it wasn't for the Dream Team. And that introduces us to Tony Kukoc, which, as we know, is part of that Bulls team. But before he was part of the Bulls team, Amit, there's a little more information about Tony Kukoc and how he was wooed to the Bulls, primarily by Jerry Krause. And I don't think Michael or Scotty appreciated it, huh?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny to see the Jerry Krause. You almost want to believe that Michael's career was made so much better because of his dislike of Jerry Krause. Like, that was such a big motivating factor for him in everything. Like, it was insane. But yeah, Tony got the bad end of that stick, man. He didn't know the guys. He didn't know Scotty. He didn't know Michael.
He's wearing Jordans. He's wearing like a Jordan jacket in Croatia.
But like, he doesn't know them. He hadn't been on the team yet. You know, none of that was. And he's living in a war-torn country. Yeah. Right. He's got all these hardships. And then these guys just tee him up.
Destroy him.
Like, just owned him. And it was sad to watch that piece, because the interview was just like, he's like, I don't know what I did. Like, I don't know these guys. Like, why are they, what did I do wrong?
And he was just a kid.
Yeah. But it was cool. For all it's worth, it was nice to see them play it out as, hey, this guy still came back, played again in the finals, showed what he was worth, kept fighting. And you got to think, like, this is one kid against arguably the best players in the world.
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's an argument. I think those are the best guys on earth playing basketball at that moment.
So, and he still held his own. So, like,
yeah, mad respect. Mad respect.
And it was cool to see Jordan kind of go back into it and say, yo, like, we're good. We were good. We were good teammates. Like, that worked out. But it's an ongoing theme that they take out their dislike for Jerry Krause on numerous players. And we see that again down the road in this episode as well.
Yeah, and I think with Tony, really, it wasn't against Tony, right? They're like, we didn't even really know the guy. The best quote, I think, from the episode really was Michael saying, look, Jerry had kids doing everything right. We won two championships. We're getting to the playoffs every year since I've been on the team, and he's fawning over this other kid. Let me adopt this other kid. Like, he's so much better than y'all, and you guys are winning. And keep in mind, too, the backstory to this was Scotty was not getting paid. So you're going to a different country and offering a guy more money than the guy who's winning for you now. And that made it personal. So that day, it wasn't Michael and Scotty against Tony Kukoc. It was Michael and Scotty against Jerry Krause in Tony Kukoc's body. So poor guy. Even Charles Barkley ran him clear over and said, well, if anybody on the Bulls going to get money, it should be Scottie Pippen, because I don't think this guy can play with us.
Yeah.
Documentary also touches on, and we talked about this in episode 5 of the podcast, Michael Jordan rarely talks about race. You know, his race, his identity with race. And I think a lot of people feel like he identifies more with money than his race. So we got some insights into the comments that he said Republicans buy shoes also. And that took place. There was a Senate race in North Carolina. Harvey Gantt, who's an African-American, was running, and he would be the first to win if he were to win. His opponent was a racist, a bigot, Jesse Helms, who actually stood against Martin Luther King Day. And Michael wouldn't come out and support Harvey Gantt. And we got an inside look into his mom's conversation with him about it. He said he donated to the campaign, but he wouldn't come out and make a commercial about it. He wouldn't come out and support him.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting. Michael, I think, has always taken that neutral approach, and he had done so pretty much his entire career, right? He didn't want to really step on anyone's toes, except for Jerry Krause. He's more than happy to step all over him. But for everyone else, it was definitely, he was very smooth in trying to kind of play the middle through everything. And to his point, he didn't see himself as Muhammad Ali, as an activist. He said, I see myself as a basketball player. That's my craft. And I think, of course, I think guys are different today. If we kind of look at it at today's athlete and some of the big names today, you see a lot more activism and a lot more, they see their platform as a space for them to engage in social justice in those ways. But in Mike's defense, I think one of the interesting pieces that I didn't realize, because, you know, this happened in 1990, so I was, what, five? Four? But it was this wasn't something that he said to, like, reporters in the interview. This was an off-the-cuff comment on a bus.
I didn't realize that either.
Because the way it's reported, and even was reported then, and sort of how it kind of took a life of its own, it seemed like it was almost like an urban legend, like someone made it up. But it really was. It was just an off-the-cuff joke comment. So I think definitely a lot more was made of it than it was. But it's just another kind of insight into the climate of the times. And I didn't really realize that people wanted that sort of engagement from athletes in general and the public space. So that was a cool little insight that they provided.
And I think the former Chicago resident, as he was addressed a few episodes ago in The Last Dance, but they updated him to President Barack Obama this episode, summed it up and said, you know, he was trying to find his way in society, in a sport, as a young African-American man with money and notoriety. And, you know, each person individually handles that a little bit differently. And Michael took the approach he felt most comfortable with. He told his mom he didn't want to support Harvey Gantt simply because he didn't really know him. But he would donate to him, but he didn't know him, so he didn't want to speak for him.
And that's fair. I think that's a completely fair approach. Our third and final story, we're going to jump into episode 6 of The Last Dance. And some of our takeaways, some of the highlights that we found. Telly and I kind of watched them separately, found some highlights, and then we're going to chat about them. So the first one for me was Everyone Wants to Be Like Mike kind of was his big jump into fame. And they kind of talked about that in episode 5.
Be like Mike.
Right? And that Gatorade commercial, right? And you start to realize, and I think Mike was very open and clear, like, you don't want to be Mike. Like, my life is not what you want. And it's weird, right? When you're a multimillionaire and you've got everything on earth, but, you know, he's a prisoner in his own hotel room.
Yeah. And I think it's a Mike thing, man. There's a lot of Mikes. There's Mike Jordan. Mike Tyson was balling at this time. Michael Jackson was huge at this time. Mike Lowry is one of my favorite Mikes. So, you know, it's something with the Michaels.
Listen, if I have a kid, I'm going to have to name him Mike.
That's what I'm saying. If you name him Mike, it's like automatic he's going to make it.
That's right.
So Michael is talking, and I think one of the parts, to your point, Amit, he's in the hotel room, and the NBA crew gets access, The Last Dance, 1998, and they're sitting there, and he's just laying down and laying it on the line and just saying, like, dude, this is no life to live. Like, this is no lifestyle. He's tired. He pulls out a cigar. He's watching TV, and he's like, this is the only moments I get to myself, and even you guys are in here. And so, you know, it shows the price of fame. And I think episode 6, they did a great job of showing, like, how great fame can be. And I want to be like Mike. Even Charles Barkley was singing, he wants to be like Michael Jordan. And then Michael clarifies and says, you know, I think this episode goes a little bit into the dark side of that and what can come out of that and what kind of stones can be unturned, right?
Once the thought process is everyone wants to be like Mike, then people start digging into what is it like to be like Mike. And that's where we get the Jordan Rules book, right?
Yeah, written by Sam Smith, who we thought was like a good guy in this story. And they portrayed him as like this nice writer for the Chicago Tribune. And he comes out with this book and like, bam, here you go.
But here's the thing. I thought it was so funny. Sam Smith sits there and he writes this kind of like a tell-all inside the locker room book about what's going on with the Bulls and what's going on with Jordan and the power struggle and all those different things. And in the end of it, he's like, and I really think this book is going to really propel them and bring them together, as if him writing the book is what got them to that title game in 98.
Yeah, and they're asking who leaked. Watch out. If it's as competitive as Mike was, Mike leaked all this stuff about himself and got himself motivated so he could win this last championship. I'm a little bored. You know what? Everybody hates me. I punch guys in the face. And I'm hard to get along with. Write that, let it spread like wildfire, and I'm going to go ahead and take this championship and walk out into the sunset.
But this gambling part that they brought up, you know, when we talked a couple episodes back, you know, when it was like, hey, what are we excited to see about in The Last Dance? That this was one of the things that I was really interested to see how it would play out and sort of, because it's always been part of his lore. Part of his image is that he has a gambling problem, he really enjoys it, he's kind of addicted, and we really see it kind of play out here in not only in the Jordan Rules book, but really in all the little segments, whether it's gambling on the plane. And I mean, they were playing, you know, I get that big money isn't different, right? So Mike gambling $10,000 is like you or me gambling $10. But
yeah, that's right.
When you start owing your bookies, you know, 57, 80,000, 90,000, I think the one book that they had about him, he had a golf bet worth 1.2 million. Right.
So, that book was written by Richard Esquinas, and it comes out right around the time they're hitting the playoff stride here in 93.
So there was a lot out there. It was definitely the darker side of him. It brought out the competitiveness in him. So I think there's, you know, it's like the good and the bad, right? So yes, this drives him because he has this need to like be the best and be competitive, right? Mike doesn't have a gambling problem. What does Mike have?
He has a competition problem.
Right?
I got a problem. I know that.
That's right. But, you know, he plays it off. And of course, you know, when we look at the production of this, Mike's guys are on this, right? So they're going to keep his image as clean as possible. So there's definitely a lens to how the story is being told so far. But, you know, it was kind of interesting to see that trip to Atlantic City. That's not a quick trip. He takes this casino trip, this Atlantic City trip, and he says, okay, that's fine. You're going to come at me like that. And then essentially, he beats up the Bulls. Or he beats up the Knicks. He just takes it out on them.
And I know you pick on the Knicks a lot on this show. I know. It's a pain from the inside, really, you know, because that's your team and they're there. But these were real Knicks, Amit, that he beat. The Knicks reached the Eastern Conference semifinals 11 times in 12 years. From 89 to 96, and Michael stopped them more than half of those times. They're up 2-0. John Starks dunks on Michael Jordan. He just dances on the baseline, dunks on Jordan, and dunks on Horace Grant, both. John Starks is like 6'1", 6'2", 6'3". I mean, they're not talking about a giant dunking on both of them. Michael goes to the casino, comes back, and so we can go beyond the numbers here and give you some stats. What did Michael do to the Knicks? He dropped in game three, they're down 2-0 to the Knicks. In game three, he drops 22 points, 11 assists. In game four, what does he do? After the media got pissed him off, and in the documentary, they're showing that they're on the court while they're trying to practice and Mike is irate. I think he stopped talking to the media after that. He drops 54 points on 60% shooting. 60% shooting. Game five, he drops 29 points, 14 assists, 10 rebounds for the triple-double. And then in the closeout game, game six, he drops 25 points to go along with 9 assists to close them out and sweep the Knicks after going up 2-0.
But let's be honest. Let's be honest. What's the turning point in this series?
Oh, man, when they stopped Charles Smith. That
how many times does that ball just not fall in the damn basket?
It was over there, but that's one of the that has gone down as one of the best defensive plays in NBA history. You got Horace Grant, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen all mauling this guy. Poor Charles Smith, who's like forgotten in history. And where was Patrick Ewing? That was Patrick Ewing's to make. Charles Smith. That's like when Mike said, you know, I don't want Bill Cartwright taking the last shot. That's my last shot to take. If I miss it, I shot it. MJ shot it. Patrick should have had the same feeling. Charles Smith shouldn't be nowhere near that ball at the end of the game to decide that game.
How many rebounds were on that? How many rebounds were on that shot?
There was a lot of rebounds. I mean, I did a lot of shooting, Captain. I mean, I did a lot of shooting. You know, I did. I could have shot. I did a lot of shooting.
So, I mean, that was the moment, right? Because that was the swing game, right? You either go up 3-2 or you're down 3-2.
Yeah,
that changed everything for them. But you are right. Those Knicks were that was a real Knicks team. And I don't think they've really had a team like that since then. You could argue that the early 2000s Knicks had a little bit of something when they had Latrell.
Oh, yeah. That's why they brought in Latrell, but yeah.
But
not like this team was gangster. And this was the reincarnation of the Bad Boy Pistons, and that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to get physical. They were trying to bring the fight. You know, right. Jordan had won twice. Jordan is not hungry no more. The Bulls are already winning too much. We're hungry. We're the new Chicago Bulls trying to dethrone you guys. You guys have won 2 in a row. Just like Detroit had.
It's not a foul until you take blood, my friend.
And we already know Oakley. You know, you already know Oakley's a thug now. Oakley walks up in MSG now doing that. Imagine when he's a young buck. You know, why?
That's true.
Him and Ewing. And
they hated each other.
Yeah.
And it was so the Bulls, of course, you know, as they do, managed to get past the Knicks in a hard-fought battle. And what is their next step? The Phoenix Suns, right? They got Charles Barkley, the MVP of the league. And this is another one of those moves, right? Where Jordan's like, all right, Chuck, you got the MVP. You can take that. I'm going to take this.
As we discussed, Beyond the Numbers, episode 5, the first three-peat ends with Charles Barkley taking the MVP trophy of the league. And you could tell in the documentary, they're interviewing Mike present day, and he's still pissed that he didn't win. And he's like, man, you know, they gave it to Charles, but I'll take this trophy right here. I'll take this championship trophy right here. But it also gave us a chance to look, Amit, and we talked about the pain Michael inflicted on poor Tony Kukoc. There was another child that Jerry Krause was fawning over as he presided over the Bulls as general manager. And poor guy, because he caught the eye of Michael and Scotty. And as Michael said in the documentary, that's all it took, man. Jerry liked this dude, so I was coming for this dude's head.
Yeah, I mean, was it Merrill?
Dan Marjorie.
Marjorie, that's right. That's
and
right.
Marjorie, who Jerry Krause thought was a great defensive player. So you know what Mike's going to do every time he gets the ball.
Yeah, I was going to prove him wrong. And he did. Oh, my God, did they make him look bad.
Yeah, poor Dan Marjorie.
Who I think is a coach in the league now, if I am not correct.
He's gone on to be very successful in things other than guarding Michael Jordan, as many people in life have.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
So Charles puts the game on his back. It's not a series. They get blown out game one. And Charles now, today, when they interviewed him after the documentary, says, we just weren't ready. And it was the same effect Michael had when he played the Lakers and Magic Johnson. Their first championship was he just wasn't ready. Game one, they were full of nerves. They were nervous. And Charles took full responsibility for that. So Charles showed up in one of the games of the series and took over the game. But they head back to Chicago, Ahmed, for game five. And Chicago made a mistake, I'll say. They made an error.
They thought it was done. They were celebrating. They thought it was game over.
And Charles said, hold on, hold up, hold up, hold up. This ain't over till it's over. And Charles Barkley showed why he was one of the best players on the planet at that point and the MVP of the league.
No, that extra chip on their shoulder definitely gave it to them. But, you know, you realize how much of a mental game this was. I mean, everyone is so good at this level that you're looking for that extra edge, right? Everyone knows it's for the championship. Everyone's going for the title. You've got some great talent on there. So everyone's looking for an edge. For Chuck, that was, hey, we're being disrespected. They think this is done. They still got to win another game. We're not losing this one here, right? So he does that. And then what does Michael come back and do? On the way to Phoenix.
Hey,
I'm only packing one suit.
Yeah, just I'm only packing a suit.
So we got to, there's just one more game. We're not taking this to seven.
Because right? He could do that.
And then in the craziest stat line that I can think of, game six, game on the line, in the fourth quarter, Michael is the only one to score any points. All fourth quarter points are Michael Jordan's points.
Yeah.
Except
John Paxson. John Paxton, who, as we discussed in the previous episode of Beyond the Numbers, won the first finals for the Bulls and shot the decisive shots against the Lakers. Okay, comes back and does it here. Shoots another the daggers. Dagger.
A huge three.
Shot the daggers. No wonder he's working with the Bulls now.
That's right.
When they interview him, he's sitting in the Chicago Bulls, their meeting room or wherever, he's wearing his Bulls Nike shirt. Like, John Paxson has his legacy sealed right there. He's the guy that took the clutch shots.
Yeah, but it was so crazy to think, man, Michael, you scored every point in the fourth quarter except for the last dagger that put it away. And so that's crazy. That's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, and for Mike, it was personal. And like you said, it goes back to, I have a competition problem. He was already, and as we discussed in episode five of the podcast, that, you know, when he went on to baseball, he was already contemplating leaving in 92. And the only reason he didn't, Ahmed, Magic and Isaiah both won back-to-back championships. They hadn't won three in a row. That's why Mike hung around, was to win three in a row, let everybody know he was king of the mountain, and, you know, before he was thinking about walking away.
Yeah, and you could see he was exhausted mentally, physically. It was just, it had taken too much out of him at that point.
We cannot wait for the next episode of The Last Dance, Ahmed. Please, Beyonders, be sure to check out episode 4, 5, and 6 of our podcast, of Beyond the Numbers podcast. In episode 4, we tell you all about Michael Jordan before he won any championships and go beyond the numbers of his career during that time. In episode 5, we go beyond the numbers of Michael Jordan's first three-peat. And episode 6, we actually give you all of Michael's baseball stats. and cover the second three-peat. So be sure to catch up on the episodes. And it looked like the teaser for this week was his baseball career. So let's wrap this thing up. In our first story, we showed you that MJ still had some magic left in his time with the Wizards, averaging 22-5-5, giving us a 40-for-40 and becoming the oldest player ever in league history to score 50 points or more in a game. In our second story, we talked about episode 5 of The Last Dance, Michael Jordan versus the Dream Team versus Isaiah, and MJ versus Kobe. And for our final story, we talked episode 6 of The Last Dance, The Price of Fame, MJ's gambling, and his destruction of the Knicks. Thank you for going beyond the numbers with us. We're a weekly podcast dedicated to going beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. We're available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Whatever you're listening on now, please be sure to click the follow or subscribe button to get our latest content.
And remember, you can find us on Instagram, Beyond the Numbers Podcast, and on Twitter at Beyond TN Podcast.
Until next time, peace.